I thought we ought to start today by adding something to our list of birthdays, okay, the back of your bulletin. It happened yesterday rather than this coming week. And that is, we ought to list the United States of America, right? And so I want to start by saying, happy birthday to my country. Happy birthday, America. Yesterday marked the 239th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Our founding fathers, as we all know, were revolting against oppressive policies by the British government in those days. And as Betty reminded us in her children's message, they were revolting on behalf of freedom, individual freedom, the ability of individuals to make choices for themselves. And you know, from that day to this, for all of our political differences and for all the hatred and sometimes very unseemly things that happen on the political scene, I think almost all Americans are dedicated to the same basic project. Deep down, we want freedom. We want to preserve freedom for individuals. And that's what our country is all about. I was thinking, as Betty defined freedom for the children in the children's message, what a good definition it was. That Betty defined it as being able to do what you can, being able to choose for yourself. And on the political scene today, we have conservatives, the people on the far right. They believe that freedom is being able to choose, okay? And they put a real strong emphasis on the you part, okay? It's you are able to choose, and they think of freedom as non-interference. And so for them, what freedom means is nobody makes rules or regulations to try to keep you from exercising your own choice. And you are most free when there are fewer regulations and rules that are telling you what to do. It's up to you. Freedom becomes non-interference. For Americans on the other side, they too love freedom, but they think of freedom with the emphasis on choose. Okay. It's not you so much as you have choices to make. And people on the progressive side, as they like to be known, on the more left wing of things these days, they like to think of freedom in terms of having opportunities, having choices that are available to you. And you can be enslaved by all sorts of situations that are in your culture that keep you from having choices, can't you? So instead of thinking the main enemy of freedom as being the government making rules, they think of the main enemy of freedom as being social and economic conditions that limit your choices. Things like poverty, things like illiteracy, things like racism, and so forth. And those kinds of things become the big enemies of freedom. But you know what? For all of their argument and all of the heat, don't they deep down have, despite their differing view of it, an equal devotion to freedom? We live in a country in which everyone is doing their best to preserve our freedoms, and I certainly think that is the right project. And America has been the story of people working together trying to do that job. Today, I think it's fitting that we talk about that, because I really think that the American project has very definite Christian roots to it. And I'm going to talk a little bit at first about why some people don't think so. Actually, a lot of Bible scholars don't think so. And it's amazing how many of them will say that this really isn't a Christian country, and that people are wrong to think that it is founded on Christian ideas, that it really was founded on secular ideas. And when I was a young man, I kind of thought they were right, because their arguments rest on some things that really are true. The trouble is, they're not the whole truth. And I've come through the years to think that they're wrong at the deepest level. And so my main message today is that our country really is founded on Christian ideas, on the most important Christian ideas. And that it also will point the way for how we can be good citizens in this great nation. Why do people who deny that our country really had a Christian foundation do that? They have four main arguments. Okay. One of them is that when we read those statements that people like to quote from the New Testament about freedom, if we just read them in a single verse, it may sound like it's about political freedom, but when we check it out in the context, plug it back into what's being talked about, we see it isn't. Every time. You get out your concordance, look up words like free, freedom, liberty. Look at the verses, you'll find it to be true. Here are a couple of examples. Our Lord in John 8 said, "You will know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." We've all heard that, haven't we? And in my job as a teacher through my long career, I have bosses who like to quote that off and make it a slogan for what we were doing at the university. And they like to interpret it as, if you get a good education, well, then you're in a better position to exercise and protect your freedoms. And you know what? I think that's true, don't you? We need a solid educational system to protect our democracy. And if people can't think for themselves, the next step will be a threat to our freedoms. There's no question about it. You have to defend the ability of people to think well for themselves if you really believe in freedom, lasting very long at all. Otherwise, we're just at the mercy of demagogues, just at the mercy of propaganda. So that's true, but you know what? That isn't what Jesus was talking about. The people that Jesus was talking to thought he was talking about political freedom. They object, saying, why, we're not slaves, we're free people. And he said, I wasn't talking about that. He said, the truth I'm talking about is not education, it's me, Jesus. He is the truth. And the kind of freedom he was talking about was freedom from sin. Well, that wasn't about politics, was it? Take another one from Galatians. Paul there writes, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand fast, therefore, and not be entangled again in a yoke of bondage. Okay. So Jesus died to make us free. Don't give up that freedom. Be vigilant about it. Okay. Well, when you check out the context for that comment, you find out he wasn't talking about politics. He was talking about the fact that a lot of new Christians who had a Jewish background thought that to become a Christian, you had to also become a Jew. You had to be circumcised and keep all the rules and regulations of Moses' law, too. And they couldn't see how God could just save a regular Gentile without them first doing all of those things as well. And Paul is saying, no way. The new covenant stands on its own. God made us free from the rules of the Old Testament system, circumcision and all those other rules and regulations. Stand fast, therefore. Don't get mixed up in that again. It's not that kind of thing. So Paul was talking about freedom, but not political freedom. He was talking about freedom from a system of rules and regulations. I could look at more, but I think the point is there, that if you look them up in context, these people remind us they weren't about politics. Second of the arguments they use is the New Testament doesn't prescribe any particular political system. If anything, it kind of yawns at politics. I'm afraid that's true. When Jesus is confronted with opportunities to speak on it, he always directs people away from it to a more foundational issue, our relationship to God, over and over. And the people of Jesus' day expected a Messiah who was going to start a political revolution. Did they get it? No, his kingdom was not of this world, and he had to keep saying no and distancing himself from that. Nowhere in the New Testament do you find anything like a constitution. Nowhere in the New Testament do you find anything that says the right kind of government to live under has the following characteristics. The third argument that you'll run into is the New Testament actually commands Christians to live obediently under even very bad rulers. You know, Paul says this more than once. The situation was a lot of Christians had developed the idea that since they weren't under the rules and the regulations of Moses' law, that therefore they weren't under any rules or regulations at all. And they started teaching Christians don't have rules, just do whatever you want to. And Paul says, big time mistake. That's all wrong. That God set up governments on purpose to keep law and order. And Christians must be law-abiding citizens. And even a bad government, if it's keeping law and order, that part of it should be obeyed. We find that even when there are great opportunities for Christians to do political things, they're pushed in the background. Christian principles imply so strongly that slavery is wrong. It doesn't take much reading to see it. And yet it says, slaves, don't revolt, be good slaves. Masters, keep in mind that in God's sight, there's no difference between you. It tells people to live in the conditions under which they live. And Christians did that. The fourth argument these people will use is that a good many of our founding fathers, maybe the majority, weren't Bible-believing Christians. And I haven't tried to do a nose count, and people kind of argue about some of them. It's certainly true for a lot of them. Okay. We have examples of strong Bible-believing Christians. John Adams would be perhaps the best case, but there were others too, who would have believed the Bible just like you and I do, and really wanted what he did and what he stood for to come from it. We have people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin who wrote what were called deists. They believed in a God, but they didn't believe Christianity. They just believed that God had made the world and it worked kind of like a clock, ticking along by its own inner mechanism. They didn't accept that Jesus was the Son of God. They saw him as an important moral teacher. They didn't think it made sense to pray for anything to be different. They didn't believe God worked miracles. This is Jefferson. This is Benjamin Franklin. And that probably was the majority view, actually, of many of the founding fathers. We had some who were religious skeptics, period. The best example of that is Thomas Paine. He thought religion showed a sign of weakness of thinking. And so some of them just heaped scorn on being religious, both deism and Christianity. These are big names, aren't they? You remember them from your history lessons? And one thing is true for all of them, including John Adams, the sincere Christian, is that they did not see themselves as instituting the beliefs of a particular religious group as the laws for the country. They were equally convinced that was wrong. They said, look at the history of Europe. Every time you try to legislate one religion for everybody, you get a war. And America was built from the beginning on religious tolerance, on the separation of church and state. Well, these people who said, our country isn't really based on Christian ideas, they mentioned those things, and you know what? Those are all true as far as they go. And if that were as far as you go, you'd about have to agree with them. Through the years, I've come to believe they're wrong, and that they're wrong at a deeper level, and that these founding fathers, including Thomas Paine, were actually founding our country on fairly definitely Christian ideas. Now, what I mean is this, and I'm going to try to make good on this with some examples, is that a culture will absorb ideas that are centuries old so that people who are reared in it, their parents will believe certain things, their institutions set up, they will soak in, they will osmose a way of thinking that's been in the culture for a long time. And these people, because they've absorbed and osmosed these ways of thinking, it'll be part of their mental framework. And they'll believe it even when they don't know where it came from. You see what I'm talking about? It was part of the culture you have. America was already 1,700 years into Christianity. You know, the history of Christianity through the centuries in Europe and so forth. When these people were speaking, Christian ideas had soaked into the culture. Christian ideas had influenced the outlook of everyone alive then. And even old skeptic Thomas Paine is full of them. All you have to do is read it to see them coming through. Here's some definitely Christian ideas that these people held, even when they didn't know where it came from. One is they believe firmly in the equality of all human beings. Is that one of our founding principles? Two, they believed in individualism. They really believed in individualism. That we are individuals, that we're not parts of collectives, that we're not important because of groups, we're important one-on-one. Think of the words of the communion song, thought of me above all. It's every one of us as an individual that is precious in God's sight. Another one is they thought that human beings were importantly different, incredibly worthwhile, that humans had a strong dignity. And so the high dignity and worth, the honor of being a human person, is a strong Christian idea. All through Christianity, you are special. You count. You're not just a little bit of nature. You're not just sort of a glorified edition of a caterpillar. And another one they believed in is freedom. They believed human beings, and the roots of this were in Christianity for sure, have the ability to make choices for themselves, and that they stand one-to-one, you know, with their Creator if they believe in a God and making those choices well, as Betty was talking to the children about. Those ideas, those big four, are Christian ideas. They were strongly in the culture. They were osmosed. Where did they come from? Well, let's consider seven important Bible teachings. These are on your bulletin handout. And I think that this is the source of those. One, absolutely every human being, no remainder, is equally a child of God and created in His image. That comes from the Bible, doesn't it? We are all created in the image of God. And that is why we're special and why we're not just beasts of the field. Like other beasts of the field. We have special powers. We have a higher kind of being to us. We are spirits as God is a spirit. And the most important capacity of a spiritual being is the ability to make choices. It is free will that separates us from being mere animals. It is free will that makes us morally responsible. Eve made choices in the garden. That was special, right? The ability to choose for yourself is what made humans distinctive, and not just like dogs or cats, however lovable and clever they are. They don't have that kind of a power. Second, absolutely every human being is loved by God and is precious in His sight. God loved me enough to die for me. I'm just overwhelmed. But He didn't love me any more than He loved any of you, did He? And isn't that true for everyone around the world, including people we don't like much and people who have done badly by us? God has loved absolutely everybody, and there's not a human individual out there that isn't precious. Do you see this idea, the incredible value of the human individual coming through in that way of thinking? And in fact, God's creative purpose, the whole reason He made the heaven and the earth, is to have children. He's bringing many sons and daughters into glory. We are all meant to come to be beings that are as much like Jesus as possible. A third teaching, every human being is someone that Jesus died for. Isn't that right? There is absolutely no one that's ever lived or will live that Jesus didn't equally die for on the cross of Calvary. That makes every one of them special and precious. That makes every one of them worthy of our having great respect for them as an individual. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him might not perish but have everlasting life. He loved the world, all in the world. It was not His will that any perish. And there's no one on the face of this globe ever that Jesus didn't die for. And Christ didn't die just for the godly, did He? No, He died for us while we were yet sinners. Fourth, absolutely every human being is my neighbor. Right? Isn't that a clear teaching? There isn't anyone on any continent, anywhere, who isn't equally my neighbor. The parable of the Good Samaritan is so well known that I assume all of you know it. I don't really quite tell the story. But you think of the parable of the Good Samaritan, it really answers two questions. Who is my neighbor? And the answer is anyone who needs help. Absolutely anyone who needs help. And Jesus told the story the way He did because He wanted to make some points. He wanted to show that racism and national citizenship were not proper elements in thinking about it. The man who helped was not a religious leader. They passed by on the other side of the road. The language is, they crossed the road so they wouldn't get involved and went on their way. The man who helped was a hated Samaritan. He was a man who of mixed race. He was a man who also had a different religious background and additional different national background, and they hated each other. Jews and Samaritans. Religious differences were one of the things on Jesus' mind. The Samaritans only partly agreed with the Jews. They believed in the same God, but they didn't do much the same after that. Kind of like Islam and Christianity, isn't it? Same God, but other things are different after that. It was the hated Samaritan who helped. Jesus told the story this way because it was a common teaching in His day that Jews thought your neighbor was just a fellow Jew. And so when God said, love your neighbor as yourself, He was just saying, do it for fellow Jews. In fact, I know a lot of Christians who feel that way. Your neighbor's a fellow American, a lot of American Christians. Your neighbor's a fellow American and maybe a fellow American Christian. I've met people who want to restrict it that much. That isn't what Jesus taught. Your neighbor's anyone, anyone whatsoever who needs your help. The other thing that parable teaches is, what should I do about it? Okay. Just sort of intellectually say, oh, everybody's my neighbor, on to the next point, so I won't miss any Bible trivia questions, right? No, you got to do something. What did the Samaritan do? He helped. He gave that man everything. He paid for him to be taken care of. And He promised that if it took more than that, He'd settle up with that later. That's the model, isn't it? What do we do about it? We help anyone who needs help, and we help them generously, and we go beyond the minimum in doing that kind of help. You know, James, in his short epistle, he uses the example of someone who just wishes someone who's hungry and hurting well as a perfect example of the kind of faith that never saved anyone. If all you do is say, oh, I wish you'd get better, you hop along and don't do anything about it. That's his example of the kind of faith that doesn't save. There's an appropriate work that goes with that. That is James's point. Well, the fifth of the claims that I have in mind is absolutely every human being is my brother or sister. Notice we're upping the ante. You have a neighbor, that's one thing. That's nice. Brother or sister, we're getting closer, aren't we? There's a very special sense in which you guys are my brothers and sisters, and people who aren't Christians are not. But there's another sense where every human being is my brother or sister. We are told in the Scriptures that we have one God and Father of everyone. If God is the Father of everyone, then everyone is my sibling. If everyone is my sibling, I should be acting like it. My brother, my sister. And wherever God has a child, I have a sibling. Six, every human being is Jesus in disguise. In Corey's communion meditation, he was thinking of the verse I have in mind for this, the very same one, the parable of the sheep and the goats. And in the parable of the sheep and the goats, Jesus compares himself when he comes to judge the people of all nations to a shepherd separating the sheep and the goats. And the ones on the sheep's side are headed to eternal life and bliss, and then the ones on the goat's side to everlasting punishment and destruction. It's serious. And the test that is given, this, by the way, is the fullest picture of the final judgment anywhere in the Bible, so we ought to take it seriously, is what did we do about needy people? Did we feed the hungry? Did we give drink to the thirsty? Did we try to clothe people who didn't have good clothes? Did we give shelter to the homeless? Did you visit and comfort the sick? Did you visit and comfort people in prison? These are his examples. And he said every time you did it, who you really did it for was, as Corey said, it was Jesus in disguise. And every time you said no and walked on the other way and didn't help, guess who you didn't help? It was Jesus in disguise. You never met anybody who isn't really Jesus in disguise in a very deep sense. We reach out to the Word made flesh in every human being in a way. And that leads me to the seventh point. There's no human being anywhere who isn't born with the potential to be like Jesus, to really have the reality of Jesus' new kind of life start to take root and grow in them. That's what's so special about being a person. The only person who was ever perfectly what God intended was Jesus himself. And when we become Christians, he puts a new seed of life in us. He scrubs away the old sins. He puts within you the seed of the Spirit. And this life is about growing and maturing it as fully as we can. And we're not going to get that far in this life, are we? God is going to have so much that he'll have to keep doing. But we carry beyond the grave the seed of a new kind of life already planted here. And when that new kind of life grows up, every one of us is going to be the Word made flesh. We'll all be different. But you will be as Christ-like as you can be with your limitations, and I will be as Christ-like as I can be in my limitations. And think of all the billions or maybe trillions of humans that will ever exist. Every one of them is a translation of God's great plan for human nature into something with legs and arms that walks on this earth, but something that will someday have a new body and live with him forever. Of how many people is that true? 100%. Now think about these seven. I could have gone on, but think about these seven really strongly Christian ideas, aren't they? These are ones that are bedrock to our faith, everything I've talked about. And what happens when they run together? Are humans equal? You bet. What about individualism? Wow, isn't that strongly called for? Respect for the individual, not just collectives. Are humans special, not just fancy animals? You bet. And what is the key mark of their specialness? Their freedom. The ability to choose as God would have us choose, to align our will with his. So, you know, we Christians do well to honor America not just as our country, but as a country that is strongly founded on Christian values, for it definitely is. But you know, one other thing is clear from those verses. We would be wrong to honor America as a finished project, something done 239 years ago that we just keep polished and remembered. Isn't this project of honoring individuals and their equality and their freedom and their worth an ongoing story? Has it been done perfectly in our country? No. That's too bad. We try, but we haven't. And we should do everything we can to make America more what it should have been, and try it has tried to be from the beginning, a country where the worth of the human individual is the paramount value. I know what you and I can do about it. And whatever we're called to do, however little or much it may be, is that we could consciously have a set of attitudes about every human we meet. You should think when you meet anyone, and especially people who are hard to like, and we all have them, we all have people who are mean to us, we have people who hurt us, we have people who say bad things against us. And in those cases, say to yourself, this is a child of God. This person's in the image of God. Hard to believe it, but it's true. Say to yourself, this person is loved by God as much as I am and equally precious in his sight. This is someone Jesus died for. This person's my neighbor. Moreover, not just a neighbor, but a brother or sister. And you know what? More not just that, but Jesus in disguise. This person is created with the potential to be like Jesus, just as I am. If I really saw that person as they could be, I would be tempted to almost fall down and worship how glorious a being they would be. And we're all destined for that kind of glory. Well, in this way, by thinking this way, we Christians in particular become good citizens, above all of God's kingdom, but also of our great nation that we're honoring the birthday of this weekend. And when we show each and every person equally the love and the care and the respect that our Savior wants us to show them, that's when citizenship for a Christian really begins.
You've been listening to Dr. Steve Trammell at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the Donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.